are listening to radio.dominican.edu, broadcasting worldwide from Dominican University of California. Good evening, folks. This is Stuart Horn with you on Monday, the 30th of March, 2009. Tonight's broadcast from Angelico Lecture Hall. And Jermaine Greer is in the house. And she is just backstage right now. In fact, I can see her back there. Coming to the podium, Denise Lucy. We are so happy to have you with us here tonight. And now we will get started. From Dominican University of California.
Welcome to Dominican University of California's Leadership Lecture Series, and it is a pleasure to welcome you here. Thank you very much. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm a professor of business and leadership here at Dominican and the Institute for Leadership Studies Executive Director, and it is a privilege to have so many of our students here today from multiple departments. Yay! I do want to recognize some very special people, of course, I should say, and organizations that have helped make this a reality, in that if we did not have our great partner Book Passage, some of these great speakers would not be able to join us. So thank you, Book Passage, and please patronize them. This particular event, this is Women's History Month, and this particular event is also co-sponsored with the Marin Women's Commission, great, great supporters and partners to the lecture series and to the Institute for Leadership Studies. In fact, each March, we hold some kind of event around Women's History Month. And in the fall, we hold a Women's Leadership Summit. And we have a partnership that is guided by the mutual commitment that women's leadership effectively impacts systems change so that women of all ages are empowered, educated, and engaged in the community. And our lecture series seeks to do that. It seeks to welcome the public onto our campus and with our students and faculty to engage in ideas around how we can affect and make our world a better place. Also, tonight, our academic partner is the Women and Gender Studies Program. And I think Dr. Pelleggi is here, our director and her students, and welcome all of you to the program tonight. You may also have noticed that in the lobby there was a postcard for two of the remaining lectures in this series this spring. And on April 23rd, Dave Eggers will be speaking. I hope you'll join us. That's the One Book, One Marin event. It's a wonderful event where we award to that great author this year what we all will read about in the spring. And that's Dave Eggers' book. Also, Daniel Goleman on May 13th. He is the father of emotional intelligence, so I certainly hope that you will come and engage with us around those ideas. Introducing Dr. Greer tonight is a beloved partner and friend, Eileen Clark Hernandez, who is a community organizer and human rights activist for many, many years. In fact, she herself is one of among the women leaders in our country that has made such a huge difference. In fact, in 1964, President Johnson announced her, or I should say appointed her, as the only woman commissioner on the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She then also founded a consulting firm, which she still actually has, which supports American companies, government agencies, community organizations around such issues as housing, employment, education, sustainable development, and transportation. She's often on television and radio speaking about issues of human rights and gender relations. She's also the founder of the California Women's Agenda, which for the last dozen years has brought together 600 California organizations to put into reality the Fourth World Conference on Women held in 1995 in Beijing. She's also the second woman president of NOW, National Organization for Women. You have tonight a wonderful opportunity to meet Eileen Clark Hernandez.
Thank you so much, Denise. It's always such a pleasure to be here on this campus, and particularly I want to say thank you to Denise for what she's done with this forum series to bring so many people out. So give her a big hand for doing that. You've only been waiting about a year to hear our guest speaker because we all thought she was coming last year. But she did break an ankle and wasn't able to make it, so we're delighted that she is here now. And I'm particularly delighted that Denise asked me to interview her because there's kind of a connection. When I was the national president of NOW, it was in 1970 and 71, and it was right after our speaker, Germaine Greer, had written The Female Eunuch. And if there was anything that women needed to do at that time in the National Organization for Women, was to talk about what was going to happen with women. And Germaine Greer gave us lots to talk about. And it went up and down, and we had a chance to really get to know all the opportunities that there really were out there for women, and that we could select what it was that we wanted to do. There was no just one place that women had to go at that stage. And Germaine Greer has opened up a lot of those avenues in our minds about what is possible for us to do. She's unique in so many ways. Not only is she an author, but she has been, obviously, a scholar. And a lot of people did not know that when we first started out. We just figured she was one of those people who was not quite sure she was ready to be a feminist, whatever that meant in those days and whatever it still means in these days. But we now know that she was a scholar, superb scholar, in so many areas, and I think you're going to be enthralled tonight as she talks about the most recent of her books, and that's the book on what is Shakespeare's wife. And it's about Anne Hathaway, not that Anne Hathaway. This is a different Anne Hathaway, about 400 years between with the one that we probably are talking about now and our friend Germaine Greer. One of the things that is so interesting about Germaine is that she pries into everything. And while we were standing talking a little while ago, all of you probably know that she's from Australia. That's the first part. But she doesn't stay in Australia a lot. She travels very much, and she has been in the course of her just gathering more and more information as a scholar, she has been almost everywhere. And in that case, she has learned a lot about the differences that we have in our society, but also the similarities and the changes that we're all capable of making, and she's going to be talking about those too, I'm sure. So as we think about what her book is about, it is about recognizing that there are so many things out there in this new era for women that we can challenge and that we can actually make a difference on. As we think about the books that she has written in the past, she has been very interested in women artists and has done books on that. And I hope that those of you who have been here for a while have had a chance to go out and actually get some copies of her book so that you can be able to take them along with you. But I want to stop at that point because I want to give all of the opportunity for you to hear her and in the conversations afterwards to have some conversation with her. I had a marvelous conversation with her while we were just standing over in the reception. And I want all of you to put down right now, then probably in about 2 years is going to be a fabulous children's book out by Germaine Greer, and maybe she'll talk a little bit about that when you ask her the questions. So it's a real delight for me to renew an acquaintance with Germaine Greer that started back in 1971 when I found this incredibly interesting woman who came from Australia and opened up not only the hearts of feminists here in the United States, but also the minds of feminists. I introduce to you Germaine Greer.
Well, hello. I'm sorry that I'm a year late. I was in my rainforest in Queensland. I was skipping down the stairs of the slimy, moss-encrusted stairs of my rotten house in the rainforest, with some seeds in my hand that I was going to scatter through our plantings, and the stair gave way, and I sat on my ankle. And I knew immediately that it was broken. And it was Easter Saturday. I have a great skill in breaking limbs when there's nobody about to fix them. And so I kind of sat around for the rest of the evening. And then the next morning, I drove myself to hospital and hopped up the stairs and said, I've broken my ankle. They said, yes, sprained ankle. And I said, I think you'll find it's broken. So they let me sit there for half a day. And then they x-rayed my ankle and they said, we've got a surprise for you. Your ankle's broken. And so we went on from there, which was an immensely expensive exercise because it's pretty much in Australia now like it is here. They get your money first before they'll even give you an x-ray. So I did nothing but give them credit cards for 3 days. And then we had to go home and figure out what the damage was. I was going to come anyway, but then I learned that I had to give myself decoagulant injections in my abdomen with a big needle every day. And I thought, surely this is not worth it. And I hope you're not mad at me, but I really couldn't face it, so I didn't come. So here I am now to introduce to you my book, Shakespeare's Wife. You know, everyone asks me, why did I write it? And you know, the more important question is, why did I wait so long to write it? I've been a Shakespearean all my life. And from the time I was 12 years old, when I used to conduct play readings with my friends at school, we used to read Hamlet and take all the parts. I still think that's the right way to teach Shakespeare, is to read it with your friends. You don't have to stage it, you don't have to costume it, but you do have to understand who can hear, who can't hear, who's a mute on the stage, who is the observer, and so forth. And I've been doing it, I guess, ever since. But why did I never interest myself in the question of Shakespeare's wife? For one thing, when I went to Cambridge, I didn't start out to do a PhD, but I eventually decided that I'd better do a PhD, or otherwise my time in Cambridge was going to be totally wasted, because nobody wanted to actually teach me anything. So I decided, okay, fine, I'll do a PhD. And then I said, please, can I do it on Shakespeare? And they all went, you can't do Shakespeare, it's too well trodden. And I said, no, I can do Shakespeare, because the way I'm going to do it won't be well-trodden at all. I'm going to do Shakespeare's early comedies, the plays that nobody cares about, the plays that people think are clichés, the plays they think are experimental. I know that if they are experimental, there were experiments that succeeded. And I want to find out, I want to prove once for all that they are not clichés, they were not copied from European sources. These are original. These could only have come from England and only have come from Shakespeare, and they come out of the ferment of ideas that is to do with reforming Protestantism. So they said, okay, you can do that. So then I began really researching this background. And I read thousands and thousands of tracts, marriage sermons, arguments about the dignity of marriage, because it was assumed that the Catholic Church had degraded marriage. It had elevated celibacy far beyond the merits of marriage. And the reformers said, this is wrong. God married Adam and Eve in heaven. This is how he meant people to live. Now, this was a pretty extravagant interpretation of Genesis, but it became important that God had blessed the union between man and wife, and that the Catholics, in degrading it, had actually gone against the will of the Almighty. And so I remember reading books like John Bale's Acts and Unchaste Examples of the English Votaries, which was all about how convent, if you'll pardon the expression, I realise I'm in a convent now, but that convent fish ponds were full of fetal skeletons. Can you believe it? I mean, it was outrageous, the stuff. How it was assumed that all the priests were committing fornication with all the nuns. Now, that may strike you as extravagant and ridiculous, but I've got a feeling my father believed that. He thought all Catholics were complete hypocrites, and that was what was going on. Well, in the case of John Bale, he produced all these case histories. It was like CSI, you know, there was all this stuff about fetal bones and so forth. And I read all this, ploughed through all of this, and tried to work it all out, wrote in, transcribed, copied, interpreted, and eventually went to my supervisor for my PhD with this huge bundle of stuff, whacked it down in front of her and said, now, this is my preliminary research for my PhD. And she looked at me as if to say, have I got to read this? And she sort of read it. There was a red wine stain on page 4, I think, which was probably about as far as she got. And then, when I came to get her opinion of all of this stuff, she said, Jermaine, none of this is literature. You cannot produce this for your PhD. Well, some of it was, in fact, literature. In fact, in another way, it was all literature. All of these tracts, these sermons, these polemics, these arguments, these dialogues about the merits of marriage and wedding and wiving were all literature. But it wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. I was supposed to be doing Shakespeare. I was supposed to be doing Shakespeare. And one of the problems with the way we do our work in English is that we tend to do it in isolation. We don't read history, we don't read social history, and the other thing that you're probably aware of is that we don't read anything that's not written in English, which is outrageous. It's outrageous, especially outrageous if you live in England, because, you know, France is 20 miles away, and here you are madly pretending that you don't have to understand anything they say. So, I was a bit sort of chastened by this, but I could see her point. The PhD is on Shakespeare, it's 80,000 words, you can't waste it on all of this stuff. But I had done all this work, so I went across to Trinity College, to St. John's College, actually, and I knocked on the door of Peter Laslett, who is a great historian. And Peter Laslett is one of the founders of the Cambridge Demographic Study Group. And they were studying the way people married in the 16th century. They were studying at what age they got married. They were trying to figure out how the average household was composed. And I thought that with all this stuff of mine, it would add some interesting background to what they were doing. So instead of just doing this number crunching, they could actually do some contextualizing. So knock, knock, knock. Dr. Laslett, I would really, would it be all right if I came and gave a paper to your seminar? Now, this is one of the finest universities in the world. This is what it's there for, to have people interact, to have disciplines collide, if you like. But in the collision, something interesting should come out of it. So I said, please, can I give a paper to your seminar on the ideology of love and marriage, the polemic of love and marriage in the late 16th century? And he said, no. And I was embarrassed. I actually came from a more lively intellectual tradition. What was it going to cost them? Nothing. I'm going to be there, I'm going to present my thing, and no. And I said, can I ask why? And he said, well, we're interested in what people were actually doing. We're not interested in what people said about what they were doing. And I said, yes, but when people are saying things, they're also doing something. The literature is itself an event. It's something that's happening, and I'd like to discuss it. And he said, well, no. He said, what you can do for me is you can go and transcribe parish registers. And I said, well, gee, that's kind of you, but I think that the people who gave me my scholarship would be really pissed if I wasted it doing that. I said, I'll tell you what, you do that and I'll use your conclusions. Is that cool? And off I went. And the funny thing is that he and I became good friends in the last few years of his life. And one day he said to me, you know, I remember the day you came, and I remember my answer. He said, I want you to know we got it wrong. We should have actually listened to what you had to say. And it was just that at the time, they were so keen on escaping from ideology, from actually dealing with hard fact, that they just didn't want to be distracted by anything. But it was tough for me at the time. So what happened was, I took this enormous mass of material and I put it away. It's still in my filing system. In those days I would have had 4 file drawers. I now have about 140 file drawers, but it's still there. And every now and then I think, I really want people to know about this. I want them to know that Shakespeare was not using a cliche when he talked about wedding and wiving. I want people to know that his concern for this issue was a live one in his time. I want them to understand the vibrancy of the words that he used and the concepts that he used in his early plays. And then I think, oh God, who's going to read a book called Shakespeare's Ideology of Love and Marriage? I even designed the book. I found wonderful woodcuts of the actual state of marriage. And I've got mock-ups of it all over the place, but it wasn't right. So I did other things and I forgot about it. And then one day I was having to fly to Australia, as I do twice a year, and there was really nothing in the airport bookshop except Stephen Greenblatt's Will in the World. Now, I knew that he had a 7-figure advance from Norton for that book, which was kind of interesting because he was in my Renaissance Literature seminar in Cambridge. We were exactly contemporary at Cambridge, and I didn't think he was that clever. But in fact, he is a very clever man, and he did invent the new historicism. And for those of us who did history, that and wanted to incorporate our historical knowledge in our literary knowledge, that was a liberation for us. We could actually start talking about Elizabethan literature in a context. And it gave us a whole new way of making the historical narrative. So I don't want to detract at all from Stephen's contribution. I don't usually read biographies of Shakespeare. That's partly because I've had to write one for the Collins Collected Shakespeare. And I've also written my little book about Shakespeare's thought, which is now presented to you as a sort of primer of Shakespeare, which is wrong. It's actually about Shakespeare's thought, about his ideas. And it has its admirers, this little book. But now I think it's called, I can't remember what the reissue is called. But if you have that book, just remember I think it's called An Introduction to Shakespeare. That's absolutely not what it is. If I was doing that, I'd have talked about the 5-act structure, about classical plays and the structure of classical plays. I'd have talked about Terence and all that kind of thing, so that people could see where Shakespeare's dramaturgy was coming from. It's not about that. It's about his thought. It's about what you're meant to learn when you watch a Shakespeare play, which has nothing to do with ideology, nothing to do with received ideas. It's everything to do with how to think. So there I was on the plane with this book, and it's well written. It's charming in many ways, but I couldn't get over it. Stephen wanted me to believe that the man of the millennium hated his wife. I couldn't. Why? Why did he want me to believe that? There's no evidence for it, number one. But it doesn't do his subject any credit. If Shakespeare hated his wife, he could have dumped her. Except we are told that he left her after her twins were born in 1585 and went to London to try his fortune. And then he's supposed to have come back in 1612. So what did he say? Hi, honey, I'm home. If he hated her, why did he come home? Isn't that a craven and awful thing to do? To come back to a wife whose physical presence makes you sick? He actually elaborates it. It was her physical presence he couldn't stand. Now, somebody said to me today, well, that's because he was bisexual, which doesn't follow. I'm sorry. If they'd said he only liked furry rabbits, that might mean something, but bisexual? I mean, doesn't that mean that anybody will do? I don't get the connection there, I'm sorry. So anyway, I sat on the plane. By the time I got to Singapore, I was ready to chew that book up and spit it out. I was so angry. And it was only flying from Singapore to Brisbane that I thought, I know what to do with all that stuff. I will write the story of Shakespeare's wife. Because Stephen had made some guesses about Anne Shakespeare. But I figured they were really bad guesses. Why did I think they were bad guesses? Because in the last 50 years, 50 to 70 years probably, we have made huge strides in understanding the social history of England in the 16th century. A huge amount of work has been done. And I am really annoyed that my colleagues don't use it, that they insist on carrying on the 19th century traditions. You see, when the scholars really got to work on Shakespeare, it was the 19th century. We have people like Halliwell Phillips, who read every single piece of paper that survived in Stratford, looking for the name Shakespeare. Wherever he found it, he recorded it. And we haven't gone much further since. He's the man who found all the bits and pieces of court cases involving payments for malt, this, that, and the other. And of course, when it was discovered by people like Halliwell Phillips that Anne Hathaway gave birth to her first daughter only 5 months, 6 months after a special license was secured for her to marry William Shakespeare, as far as the 19th century scholars were concerned, that was it. They knew that she was 8 years older than Shakespeare, and that's a Don's nightmare. Because all their white-haired boys, all their lovely, clever boys, the one thing they worry about is that some unscrupulous female will wrap her legs around them and wreck them forever. So there is Shakespeare, hello trees, hello sky, and out of the hedgerow steps this hairy farmer's daughter, drags him to the ground, and has her wicked way with him. And they have to say to me, well, you know, she was on the shelf. She's 26? On the shelf. Okay. And that means that she was hideous. Because if she hadn't been hideous, someone would have snapped her up. So clearly she is ugly, she is old, and she is desperate. So you say, well, what about Shakespeare? Are you trying to tell me he's a complete drip? That he can't see this thing coming towards him? This hairy seducer? But you see, the thing they're all thinking is that we're still at the beginning of Pride and Prejudice, you know, and that unmarried girls are all sitting with their feet under their father's table waiting for someone to come along and marry them. It's not what happened. in Elizabeth, England. In Elizabeth, England, everybody worked, and that includes women. Anne Hathaway would have been put to work when she was still a child. Her father was a copyhold farmer. We know that. We have his will, and we have his house in Shottery, which is the Anne Hathaway's cottage that when you go to Stratford, there you can be shown. We have his will. We know that he was a farmer who had some strips of land under cultivation. He had a handful of sheep, and he was in the top 25% of Stratford population in terms of income, but he was still a hard-working, poor man, and he had a very large family. We've lost Anne's siblings, except her brother Bartholomew. We've lost her sister Catherine, and we've lost her brother. Now, we might find them. The reason why we've lost them is that we've never looked for them. Because my friends, the scholars of the 19th century, like Halliwell Phillips, they weren't looking for Hathaway. And the Hathaways had an alias. They were also known as Gardner. Now, we don't really know why they had this alias. They're not uncommon in the period, but what they mean is a bit confusing. It might mean that these were the Hathaways who were gardeners, as distinct from the Hathaways who were coopers, say, makers of barrels or whatever else, but it doesn't seem to be that. It might mean that they inherited from somebody called Gardner and therefore they had to assume that name. We really don't know what that means, but it gives us two ways of identifying our Hathaways, and we should have explored them. Have we? No. Why have we not? Because we really don't care about Shakespeare's wife. Well, I care about Shakespeare's wife, partly because I don't want Shakespeare to turn out to be a complete hypocrite. I want to believe that Shakespeare did rely on his marriage, that he was serious about his marriage, didn't expect it to be an orgasm every 5 minutes, but he did expect it to be a relationship that endured, where they were bound to each other and in honour. So, if we start thinking, hang on a minute, we know she must have been born in about 1556 because of her gravestone that gives her age when she was buried in 1623. So, that gives us an age for her, 26. Now, the thing about that is that that's the right age to be married. The wrong age is 18, especially for a boy in this period. Most people were married in their mid-20s. Why? Because they had to wait until their parents died or became infirm and they had a property to take over. People didn't live in extended households in this period in England. In fact, it looks as if they never did in England. And one of the reasons why England develops the way it does and becomes the cradle of the bureaucracy is that we have, instead of having extended families as the focus of industrial action, we have single couple households that employ people from other people's households. So you have a different set of relationships, and this is something we need to think about. So, there is Anne, not hanging around in Shottery, wondering what to do with herself till she's 26. The chances are that she had been at work since she was about 10 or 11. And we know this because we have documents about the employment of little girls. And we also know that half of the apprenticeships entered into in this period were for girls. So girls were as likely to be apprenticed as boys. This means you have to turn your head around. We haven't got silly girls sitting around waiting for a man to come along. We've got working women. There is a downside to this, which is that about 20% of people in Elizabeth's England never married at all. They were in service. They didn't have the opportunity, they didn't meet people, or their employer did not permit them to marry. So we've got to really think hard about this. It is true that the past is another country and they do things differently there, but they don't do them so differently that you can't understand them. So what happens? We've got Anne either worked for her father on the farm in Shottery, or she was sent to work on another farm, or she went to work in some other capacity. She had a trade. She had a skill. Now, we may find out about this if we look, but in the past, we haven't looked. We haven't been interested. We haven't cared. But I think it's important to begin to care, because she's a real person, and she's taken such a slagging from the people who've written about Shakespeare, and it's so unfair. She was true to her bond. When he came back to Stratford, she was still there. She had brought up his three children. What else does she have to do to be treated with a modicum of respect? So then you think, well, hang on. We don't have the marriage. We don't actually know where they were married. They weren't married in Holy Trinity, Stratford. So that suggests to me that they were married from somewhere else where she was working. Do you see how that changes everything? You can't think about, there's Shakespeare hanging around Stratford and suddenly here is this girl hanging around the bus stop. It's not like that. If he had to actually go find her, then we've got a situation which requires much more from him. And it suggests something that is, to me, not completely shocking, that he actually wanted her. He went after her. She was the thing, the person that he wanted. Remember Bassanio and Portia? Any reading of that play, you have to think that Portia is much more mature than Bassanio. No one's counting the years, but Bassanio is a boy. And Portia is a woman of substance, a clever woman, a resourceful woman, and a prize for the boy Bassanio. Now, if you go right through those early plays, you see that pattern coming back and back. Rosalind teaching Orlando how to make love is an echo of Sylvia teaching Valentine in The Two Gentlemen how to make love to her. And he's so dim, he doesn't figure out what she's just done. What she does is, if you remember in the play, she says to Valentine, I need a love letter. Please write me the best love letter that you can. The poor old Valentine, that's the best. Oh, yeah. And then appears, here's my best love letter. And she says, keep it. And he goes, what? I really worked very hard on it. No, she said, keep it. It's for you. And Valentine doesn't get it. He's such a drip. And his servant says to him, hey, her love hath taught her love himself, you, to write unto her lover, you. Oh, says, oh, just about getting it. And you know how, well, I hope you know how that play ends. That is a very ironic and strange play, because Valentine still doesn't get it at the end. And Proteus tries to rape Sylvia. And Proteus thinks the correct thing to do after that is to make a present of Sylvia to Proteus. So it's not surprising that Sylvia ends the play completely silent. And if you're producing the play, you have to work out, is she going to be standing downstage going, or is she going to be joining in with the happy fun? I don't think she possibly could. So then let's think. If she's working, what was she doing? We don't know, and we may never find out. One of the things that makes me feel a bit nervous is that she could have been working for Shakespeare's father. Shakespeare's father, if you remember, was a glover. And part of the process of making gloves involves women. Women used to sew together the tranks, and the tranks were the cut-out pieces. You know how gloves are made? You have the one side, the other side, and then you had the bits that go down the middle. And the women would sew those with these little tiny stitches. I hate that idea. I don't know how you feel about it, but I just think, you know, if his father was her boss and he was the young master and he seduced a member of his father's workforce, that is kind of crap. And I would rather he didn't do that. But he may have done that. I tend to think it's something a bit different. Now, what did he have, this boy? He had nothing. He had no prospects. His father, I don't think his father was still working as a glover, which is one way out of this problem. But it may be that when his father collapsed as a glover, Anne had moved on to somewhere else to work for another glover. We won't know till we look, and we haven't looked. I think of it this way, that I think it was quite likely that Anne Hathaway was already promised to someone. Do you remember Audrey in As You Like It? Do you remember Audrey has a boyfriend called Will, which is quite funny? And she's being seduced by Touchstone, who is a terrible shit, basically. But he also has pretensions to be a poet. He thinks he's Ovid among the Goths. Do you remember all that? And he's saying to her, you know, he would rather she were poetical. Why does he want her to be poetical? Because he can seduce her so much more easily if she's dazzled by the fact that he's a poet. And it may be a joke that Shakespeare was having against himself. That he was both Will and Touchstone, or either Will or Touchstone. But think, there is Anne with her future mapped out. She has to marry the son of one of their neighbours in Shottery. That's how things went. It's already beginning, you know, it's been set up since they were kids, and they're just waiting for the whole thing to mature. And then along comes this seducer, this clever boy. And in the book, I talk about the lover's complaint, because the seducer in the lover's complaint is a boy. He hasn't even got a beard yet. He's got long, silky brown hair that blows across his face, and he is completely ruthless as a seducer. And the girl he seduces knows what's happening, knows that he's a liar, knows how many other people have been done in by this absolutely ravishing boy, and still he seduces her. And at the end of the poem, she virtually says, "I would forgive him everything if he would come back to me." And there's nothing for Elizabethans. Nowadays we think a roué is like, you know, a lounge lizard, a 30-year-old man who's cool and knows what he's doing. The Elizabethans didn't think that way. They thought of a seducer as a randy boy who was more beautiful than he would ever be again in his whole life. So here we've got 18-year-old Shakespeare, who has the beauty of any 18-year-old boy. I don't think we can argue that he was super beautiful, despite the Cobb portrait, which isn't him, but we can discuss that later. And I'm thinking, what did he have to offer? You know, I am quite simple-minded. I have no objection to considering the obvious. If you think, now, here is Shakespeare. His father's broke. His father is also a crook. His father daren't leave the house because his creditors may grab his body in lieu of payment. People were loath to do that because you don't really want a body when what you're looking for is money, but it did happen. What did he have? Well, bless my soul, poetry. Obviously. So, you remember that, are you poetical, that whole thing to Audrey? Maybe Anne was poetical. Oh, you can't say that to my colleagues. What do you mean? Of course she couldn't read and write. They want to think of her as this kind of hairy yokel who isn't any threat to them. You see, because the thing they all want to feel is that if they'd been around, they would have been Shakespeare's best friend. But in fact, he detested academics. There's the bad news. Sorry, guys. So, okay, supposing he was poetical, they really want me to believe that Anne could not. Well, what they say, because they don't really understand the history of literacy, what they say is, well, Anne was illiterate. Well, there are two things involved in literacy. One is reading and one is writing. Writing is hard to come by in the 16th century. You need a writing master. You need ink, which is expensive and difficult to make. You can make ink. I'm sure you've tried. You can make it with all kinds of strange things. But the really killing thing is paper. which is enormously expensive in Elizabethan England. And you just can't even buy it. It's not even around very much. People learn to write on a slate, but writing on a slate is very different from writing a letter or writing on a piece of paper. But reading is a completely different thing. We know that Anne's brother Bartholomew, who I think is really a cool dude, I really like him. He's a reforming Protestant, i.e. Puritan with a small p. He's a church warden in Stratford, which means he can read and write. It also means that he has an income of £50 a year. So when you're thinking about, we've been encouraged to think of the Shakespeares as people of substance, even though all the evidence is that they weren't. We've never been encouraged to think of the Hathaways as a big, strong, wealthy, hard-working, well-centered sort of family. But there is Bartholomew, who was married to an heiress 3 weeks after his father died, probably because the marriage negotiations had been completed and there was no excuse for not carrying on. He moves back to Stratford and rents a house in Ely Street. And I think he did that because his sister was marrying a boy. And he was worried that he needed to keep an eye on her. And we will never know just how important he was in Anne's life, unless we make a bit more of an effort. Now, if he could read and write, and if he has that kind of income, then we have to consider that Anne could read. Now, reading is easy. All you need to learn to read is a text. You can learn to read from the side of a milk float. You can learn to read from anywhere. Most of us have taught our babies to read long before anybody started to teach them methodically at school. Now, what would Anne have read? Well, the interesting thing to me is that she would have read the Bible, obviously, because salvation to the Puritans of the 16th century came in the form of a book. And it's a wonderful book. It's a great book. The Geneva Bible is the Bible that was suppressed by James I. The Authorized Version came into being as an antidote to the Geneva Bible. Why? Because the Geneva Bible was full of Republican sentiment. And it's mostly in the marginal comments on the Psalms. Things like, put not your trust in princes. That seems fairly clear. But the marginal comment made it very clear that monarchy was not a good system. So James was having none of that. James had the Geneva Bible suppressed, and he produced the Authorized Version, which we now think of as the most beautiful Bible. I've been trying to get my publishers to agree to reprint the Geneva Bible, which has the great translations by Tyndale and Coverdale, the most beautiful translations in English, especially of the Psalms. If Anne had been an ordinary Protestant girl growing up in the 1550s and 60s, she would have read in this Bible every day. And what she would have read are the Psalms. And the Psalms are great poetry. If she had them running through her head all the time, she knew what poetry was. And if she was wooed in poetry by the boy Shakespeare, she would have been aware. She might not have been very skilled as a judge of what he was doing. But it is completely wrong to suggest she would have been insensible, unresponsive to what he was doing. So if you think, here she is, there's one kind of life she should live, which is a sensible life, marrying someone with a little bit of land and with her life mapped out for her as a Hathaway of Shottery, with all her neighbours. And instead, she marries this boy. Now, I'm sure if this was the case, Then there would have been many people who are dead against it. Her own family, for one thing. You can't marry this useless child. His father is broke. He has no prospects whatever. You can't cast yourself away on this boy. And there was only one way of concentrating people's minds and making them respect your wishes, and that was to get pregnant. That was how you made them come online. You see, there's a whole different way of understanding what happened here. Now, especially if she's not even in Stratford, if he's having to travel to be with her, then it all looks much more deliberate than the idea of the shotgun marriage that she jumped him in the bushes, da-di-da. That's just kind of crap. It's not even how people live their lives. So I point out in the book just how many brides were pregnant in Stratford that year when she was married. One third of the women who went to the altar were pregnant. And if you'll pardon the expression, they were more pregnant than she was. Some of them gave birth within 3 months of being married. And it isn't a question of whether it showed or not, because nobody cared. But of course, for the 19th century critics, they were terribly worried. Oh, of course they had to hurry, because people might guess. Excuse me? She's going to have the kids baptized in Holy Trinity anyway. There's no guessing. That's pretty obvious. So you have to consider that the pregnancy was something. And the other thing is that they applied for their special license to marry when she was only about 13 weeks. And that implied, they got the special license. There was a lot of paperwork required to get that license. So they were pretty well moving on it almost as soon as they knew that she was pregnant. The one worrying thing for me about all this is I don't understand why they had to get married in a hurry. And I don't think it was the hurry that is the issue. But again, we haven't done enough work on the special license, why it was granted, when it was granted, and for what reason. We need to do more of the ordinary spade work to find out exactly what explains the way the Shakespeares lived their lives. They brought their firstborn daughter to be baptized, no shame there. And then my colleagues really want me to believe that, oh, Shakespeare was, you know, it was such a mésalliance, he must have felt dreadful about it. There he is stuck with this aging hag and her baby. Well, all I can say is he hung around for 2 years. Well, he hung around for a year while she was feeding Susanna, and then when she gave up breastfeeding and ovulated again, guess what? She was pregnant again as quick as a flash. So he must have fancied her anyway. And the next thing we know, now you see, to my colleagues this means nothing, and to me it means everything. In February 1585, she gives birth to twins. Now, my poor old colleagues think, yeah, what's special about that? Well, hang on, it's 1585. Giving birth to twins is dangerous in 2009. Nowadays, we induce women carrying twins 3 weeks early because we don't want to push them right down to full term because it's hard on the babies and it's hard on the mothers. We also monitor twin pregnancies very carefully because we want to see if there's discordancy, if one twin is not thriving, if one twin is thriving at the expense of the other. It's a tricky situation. So here am I again. The woman, me, enters this narrative, which has been told 1,000 times, and thinks, wait a minute. This is special. This is real information about this woman. So what do? I look at all the obstetrical handbooks available at the time. There's not really that many. Because mostly the women who presided at childbirth were just ordinary village women. They didn't look it up in a book. They didn't have to look it up in a book. So I don't find it much. But when I do find it, I think, my God, this is so shocking. Because what it says is things like, if both babies rush together, what the midwife must do is seize one infant and push it back into the uterus and draw forth the other. And you think, oh, my God, the chances that you'll damage the infant you're pushing back, the chances that you'll introduce air into the uterus are just so dangerous. And then when you actually look at the facts, again, back to the parish register, and there are quite a lot of twin births in Stratford, but in most cases, one baby goes into the ground in the first 24 hours of life. And in about 50% of cases, the other baby follows. And in the worst cases, the mother goes too. Very difficult to follow through because usually when twins are born, one of the babies will be put out to nurse because the mother just can't deal with it. And putting babies out to nurse has always been dangerous. And you had to have money. You had to have a nurse who was healthy, who ate a decent diet herself. It was pretty much a counsel of despair to give your baby to a wet nurse. So it's carnage. And through it all, with no fuss or bother, Anne brings forth her two babies, somehow establishes breastfeeding for both of them, we imagine. There's, as you may know, her tombstone has a poem on it about how she breastfed Susanna. And it becomes important for John Hall and his wife because they think they're gentry and they don't breastfeed their children. But Anne knew she wasn't gentry, and I reckon she just breastfed her children. And she was smart enough and strong enough and resourceful enough to know how to do it. That was enough for me. I didn't need to go any further. I knew that this was a woman who was strong and who was resourceful. If I then looked back at what all my colleagues said, they say, oh, well, maybe Shakespeare left before the babies were born. Really? The man of the millennium? That's very bad behaviour in Elizabethan England. Why? Not because he's going to have to be there teaching her how to breathe and ordering her around and all of that, but because if it went wrong, and it went wrong pretty often, she had to be able to confide her children to him, to ask his blessing, and to beg him to marry again as soon as possible so that her other children would have a mother. That's why he had to be there. He had to hear her last wishes. If he had just disappeared when she was breeding, as they used to say, he would have been a creep, no question. I don't think he did do that. I'm not sure that he ever abandoned her. Certainly she never complained that she had been abandoned. She never brought an action to find him. And you know, with a toddler and two babies, she was perfectly entitled to denounce him to the vicar's court if he had left her without visible means of support. She would not have lived with his family. His family didn't have anywhere to put her. Now, all of this is new research, and my colleagues have not taken it in, but in fact, the birthplace, which is mostly fake, was mostly leased away, and the family were living in a couple of rooms on the back. There was no way that a woman with three babies, a woman who's unable to support three babies, would turn up at her in-law's house and say, take care of us. Do you know what? They would have been perfectly justified in turning her away. That's how unusual it was, because there were people in the workhouse who had relatives in Stratford who couldn't keep them, and therefore they were taken into the workhouse. There were mechanisms for taking care of the poor, but we're fairly certain that Anne Shakespeare never had recourse to any of them. So what that suggests to me is, we have to get back and get down and start clearing our minds of all these presumptions. He didn't dump his wife and children on his parents. They couldn't have looked after them if they had. So then I think she had a way of earning her living and the living of her children without leaving the house, because she can't leave the house with twins. She can't go and work as the housekeeper in a great house, which was a very good job if you could get it, but you couldn't get it if you had three infants at foot. No one was going to give you house room. So she can't have done that. So I decided that what she did was knitting. And if you want to have a look at how and why I came to that decision, then It's one suggestion. You know, I really want you to understand something about this book. I am not doctrinaire about any part of it. It could all be wrong. What I'm trying to do is suggest that the guesses made by my colleagues in the Shakespeare industry have been really bad guesses that haven't done them any credit and haven't done the great man any credit and have been needlessly cruel and contemptuous of a person they know nothing about. And I hope, I mean, when I wrote the book, I thought it really makes me feel encouraged. I feel heartened by the alternatives. I feel heartened by the restoration of humanity to this person who became an Aunt Sally, became a joke. This is a woman who, after bringing up her children and running the big house, new place, receives her husband, probably rotten with venereal disease, and nurses him, takes care of him, alleviates his pain, is faithful to her bond. I think this woman, I don't think she's a heroine, but I think she's a decent person, and she's entitled to a fair crack, and she just hasn't had it. The most outrageous suggestion I make, which most of my colleagues just can't even bring themselves to think about, is that if you're looking for the person who found the money to indemnify the publishers of the first folio in 1623, a book which didn't sell, a book which no great collectors bothered to collect, a book that was expensive to produce, when you're looking for that angel, I think you've got to get Anne Hathaway out of the picture first. She's the one who brought up her children single-handed, who was lonely often, who slept in a cold bed because Shakespeare was helling around London. She was the one who was true to her bond. She was the one who thought it was worth doing, who thought it was... And I think, what was it like with Hamlet? You know, I think Hamlet was probably quite a sick little boy who pined for his father. What was it like trying to get him to eat up? What was it like? How many times did she gnash her teeth and think, Jesus, this is too hard, I can't do this? And then to discover after Shakespeare died that people were forgetting the plays. If he wrote them at New Place, and I think he probably did, then she knew those plays really well. And she thought they were wonderful. I don't think she liked Venus and Adonis because it was pornographic. I don't think she liked the sonnets because they embarrassed her. And sure enough, they're not in the book. All that's in the book are the plays. I think she's got as good a claim as anyone else you can mention for being the person who made sure that Shakespeare had a proper monument. And that monument, of course, is the folio. But I'll tell you, there's almost nobody out there in the Shakespeare industry who can even bear to think about it. They've got to believe that it's Hemmings and Condell. By the way, Hemmings is a shottery name. Half the people Anne grew up with were called Hemmings, and nobody knows where that Hemmings came from. Anne may have a lot more to do with Shakespeare's career than anybody has so far guessed, but it's all up for grabs. We can go out now. I'm hoping that out of this book will come thousands, literally thousands of research projects. And you know something else? I trust American students to take it on in a way that English students would not. Because the very best researchers I ever had in my teaching career were Americans. And they just don't give up. They just go on beavering away until they've got their factlet. And they come back with this dripping factlet and say, look, I mean, sometimes they come back and say, Professor Greer, we didn't find anything. And I say, you did. You found out that there was nothing there. That's the beginning. We keep on going. So I think it's exciting now. We can find out more about this woman, and that means we'll find out more about Shakespeare that won't just be hot air and foolishness, like, you know, Shakespeare invented the human. Oh, please. Shakespeare would be disgusted at the very idea. What I want you to feel when you read this book, and I don't expect you to buy it, but I do hope you read it, is what I want you to feel is a kind of excitement. Because ultimately we are going to have to tell the rest of the story of the human race. And I have begun with the wife of the man of the millennium. But I'm hoping we can continue to be interested in the way in which great talent is nourished and supported. I'm prepared to admit most of it is male. It's mostly male display. But that little brown bird scratching around next to that great, extraordinary gamecock is the reason why he's there. Okay.
We have some questions that were asked by the audience. Before we do that, my students, you have to leave. Go back to the classroom. I'll meet you there. We have a class tonight, so we have to finish.
Oh, Lord,
so,
I'm sorry.
Not at all. So there might be other students who have to leave because there is a class that starts at 8:15. So if you need to leave, students, we understand. You'll be asking the questions?
We have a handful of questions here, and then if we have time, I think we're going to have a microphone in the audience if any questions come to your mind. So the first question is, which of Shakespeare's lovers do you think most accurately reflects his own relationships? Or his relationship with Anne, I guess.
Well, that's a bit tricky now, isn't it? Because if I said Touchstone, actually I'm very tempted to say Touchstone. The funny thing about Touchstone is that he's jumped up, he's a courtier, his name is obscene. It means on the one hand that he's the touchstone that you find out if metal is current, but it also means that he touches his testicles all the time. And what he does in the play is try very hard to destroy poor Audrey by clapping up a marriage with her that would not last. That is to be celebrated by a hedge priest. And it could be an ironic side light on the way that he himself was married. He may have been like Bassanio, the gambler. He may have been, you might like to think he's like Berun in Love's Labour's Lost. Remember, Berun is the one who thinks that all this sighing after women is disgusting, making a green goose a deity. And then falls for it, just like everybody else. And on the other hand, of course, he could have been like Petruchio, except that Petruchio feels older than Katharina. That's an unusual case. Katharina is the angry girl, and Petruchio has done soldier's duty. That means he's nearly 30. So maybe Romeo, but then, you know, I don't know what you think about Romeo, but I think Romeo's a dork. And you hardly think of... I mean, I sometimes say to my students, would it make any difference in Romeo and Juliet if Romeo is 35? Because you don't know how old he is. And she is very vulnerable. We have told 1,000 times that she's 14. I think it's very risky with someone like Shakespeare to extrapolate and decide that he's one or other of his lovers. In a way, he's everybody in the plays, but in a much more important way, he is nobody.
Next. In the late 1500s, what is the significance and context of Shakespeare leaving his wife his second best bed?
Ah. Well, now, let's think. When Shakespeare and Anne were married, she had a little portion of 10 marks. I think that's £3.68, but it doesn't matter. It's enough. Shakespeare himself, should have had a portion too. And that should have been the same. So together, they should have had 20 marks to set up housekeeping. It's all over the place because he's too young, she's not. But we do know that they wouldn't have been enormously wealthy. Now, an Elizabethan bed is an extraordinary object. It is built in situ. It's built in the house. It is bolted to the rafters and bolted to the floor. It's a big wooden frame. It has webbing, maybe, or slatting, but more likely webbing. And then it has, the mattress is going to be something like corn shucks, just as it would have been for early American settlers, whatever. Horsehair, corn shucks. When you became, or it might have been even wool, because these people are raising sheep. When you become wealthy, you add things to the bed. The bed gets more comfortable, warmer. You begin to have feather beds, down. And the Puritans didn't like them because people got too comfortable and had lecherous thoughts and did stuff if they lay abed too long. So there was kind of a Puritan resistance. But then when you became wealthy, when you had a big house, especially a house where you expected to entertain visitors, then you had a state bedroom. And the state bedroom, the bed was carved. It might have been gilded. It was hung with Spanish leather or with silk. We know that New Place had a state bedroom because in 1641, when Henrietta Maria was riding north to join Prince Rupert in Oxford, she stayed at New Place, and she would have, which was the biggest house in Stratford then, and she would have slept in the state bed. So the state bed went with the house. It was part of Susanna's inheritance. It was probably the bed that Shakespeare was dying in. And you would forget to stick that in the will. Now, under normal circumstances, he wouldn't probably have had to do that. It looks to me, but I'm ready to be corrected on this, as soon as somebody's done better research than I was able to do, I think what the custom that was followed was a custom of the widow being able to take her coffer. The custom, we don't know what custom applied in Stratford. We know it wasn't widow's thirds. At least we think it wasn't, which is how people used to explain the whole will and her not being in it and da-di-da. That seems to be wrong. But there was another custom that said a widow could have one coffer in which she put all the things that she wanted to take out of her husband's estate. The coffer was the limiting condition. And in that case, if Anne had already taken what she wanted, and you might ask yourself what happened to Shakespeare's papers, because nobody knows, if she had taken her coffer, then Shakespeare had to realise that if the bed he was in went into the inventory, it would go with the house and Anne would lose it. And so therefore, you have the written in for to my wife, my second best bed. And it was not a thing done out of contempt. It was a way of making sure that she had the bed that was the bed of their life together. That's how I interpret it. There's no evidence for it being an insult, except it was interpreted that way with tremendous furore by the 19th century scholars. Oh, the scorn of it, they went on. Shakespeare didn't even write it. It was written by Francis Collins, a provincial lawyer from Warwick, who died a few months after trying to draft and then redraft the will. So I think that's how I would explain it. That was their bed. You don't let somebody die in the best bed, because dying is a messy business. Next.
What tangible feminist practices have young women integrated naturally into their lives, and which practices and principles still need work?
Well, I could answer this question. Could take me a very long time, or I could try to deal with it quite quickly. Everybody's trying to tell me that young women these days are not feminists, that they don't want to be called feminists, that feminism is a dirty word, and na-ni-na. All of which I understand perfectly. Nobody wants to inherit a philosophy of life from old people. People ask me, what have I got to say to young women? And I usually say, not a word. I don't want to put them off anything just because I seem to think it's a good idea and look at me, wizened old, fat old thing. I know that women now are much stronger, much clearer about what they expect and what they want. I think they're still very vulnerable to men. I think men still occupy far too much of their attention, and it's counterproductive because the men would like, well, the men would profit by less attention. And the women would save a lot of time and a lot of heartbreak. You know, when I was growing up, we used to sing a song called I Wish I Were a Fascinating Bitch. And I think it's a pretty good ambition. I'm going to be a fascinating bitch. I think women have been given to believe that they must have a bright and shiny pair bonding mechanism. Then they must find the right man quickly, and then they must keep him forever. They can't do too much testing and trying out because then they're going to become promiscuous, that dreadful, scary word. And all of that is really tough. And it's really tough for our little girls who are terrified to eat in case they get a fat behind. And it's very hard to explain that women are creatures that have fat behinds. That's what we are. All of that is tough and difficult, but young women know that they have to be economically self-reliant. They still are incredibly optimistic about their emotional relationship and about their pair bond and about their children. They know in a way that they're going to have all the work keeping all of this together. That the one, you know, when they say we can have it all, they forget the word work, which is what goes on the end of that thing. And a lot of them will learn the hard way, the hardest way there is, and will have to go through a divorce and then realize, my God, I will never have any leisure time. I will be poor. I will slide down one class. I'll go from B to C. I'll be the person who gets it all wrong. If my kids screw up, it'll be my fault because I didn't stay with their father. Daddy, all of that absolute emotional blackmail. And still, they say, I'm not continuing in this relationship because it is beneath me, because it degrades me, because I'm not going to go on pretending. I'm not going to live a lie. I'm going to go out there. I don't care if I'm poor. I don't care if I'm lonely. I'm going to be at peace with myself. I'm going to be proud of who and what I am. It doesn't bother me that a woman who does that is not going to turn around and say she's a feminist. You know, there has been such a caricature of what feminists are. Why would she identify it? She doesn't have to. She is the real thing. She is a self-defining woman, a self-realizing woman. And I am always stunned at how brave young women, how brave women are. The only thing I pray for is that women would be better able to support each other, that they would learn from the way that men support each other, that there's a lot to be said for just undemanding companionship, not prying, not demanding intimacy, just being there, joking, hanging out, giving each other a chance to relax. And that other thing that men do instinctively, which is to close ranks when one of their number is being attacked. I want to see women do that. I want to see women refuse to do the dirt on each other.
What other female historical figures interest you?
Well, lots of female historical figures interest me. I spent a lot of time working on Aphra Behn. I think that the secret of Aphra Behn is that she does actually come from Suriname, which means she is an American in her own term, and that the key is the Suriname synagogue. The most enduring community in Suriname was Jewish. We know that Sephardic Jewish. We know that Aphra Behn was multilingual, that she had a culture which was much more like a European culture than anything that was happening in Britain at the time. We haven't done the work on Aphra Behn, again, because we haven't been enterprising enough. Mind you, don't think for one moment you can go to Suriname and start looking at manuscripts, because they all rotted away a long time ago because nobody took care of them. But it's interesting, isn't it, the way our lives work. I'm at present working on the first settler in the valley where I have my rainforest in southeast Queensland, and he comes, his family had plantations in Guyana, which is next door to Suriname. And I tell you, I know that without looking for it, I'm going to trip over something. And at last I'll know. We know that Aphra Behn was connected with the sea traffic from the West Indies because she is named in an insurance case because for a lost cargo, and she was the insurer. We'll get there. We'll find out about who this woman is. I've already edited the works of Anne Wharton, and I think Anne Wharton was infected with syphilis when she was a tiny girl at the court of Charles II, which gives you an interesting angle on that particular monarch. She died at 26, I think, in absolute agony, terrible, terrible torments, and was all her fortune was taken by her husband, who refused to have intercourse with her because she was poxed. It's just a terrible, terrible story. And we discovered a new manuscript of Anne Wharton after I'd published the book at my own expense, so now we've got to start all over again. But I'm interested in Anne Wharton. I think it's true to say there's hardly a woman writer I'm not interested in, whose story I don't want to investigate. I have to confess, I'm normally not interested in wives at all. Because I kind of disapprove of them. And I'm much more interested in women who've struggled on their own from day one. Even someone like Letitia Elizabeth Landon, who it turns out bore three illegitimate children. I mean, it's just impossible to imagine what it was like living with that in Regency London, with people knowing about it. I mean, the gossip was awful, and I didn't believe it for years. And then suddenly, again, a bit of really hard-nosed research brings it straight smack in my face, and there's no denying it. You have to go back and have a look at her whole career. All women poets interest me, and women artists interest me too. But things aren't going well in this respect. I mean, Artemisia Gentileschi is an astonishing artist, but the latest study of her confounds her work with her father's and treats them as if they were a firm. It's an Italian book, and you probably won't even see it. I happened to be visiting friends in Italy, and I saw it on a bookstand and bought it, and I just thought, no, please. But that is, at the moment, the fashionable attitude, that she worked for her father. I don't think it's true. There's a good reason for there to be very bad blood between the two of them. And I think for long periods they saw nothing of each other. But I'm not. It's just like it is with the Shakespeare industry. I'm not supposed to be an art critic, you know. I'm not part of the establishment. So I say things and they just ignore them. But I said them, they're there.
With this book, are you frequently asked your opinion on the authorship debate? What is your opinion on the authorship debate?
What authorship debate? I mean, this is just madness, you know. There's a man called Shakespeare. He put his name to Venus and Adonis, the best-selling book for 15 years. An edition a year. This is a huge bestseller. He puts his name to The Rape of Lucrece. So there's this writer, William Shakespeare, name on two books. He has dedicated Venus and Adonis to the Earl of Southampton. You can't do that if you didn't write the book. You could dedicate an anonymous work to the Earl of Southampton, or you could not dedicate it to the Earl of Southampton at all. But it doesn't make sense to not be you and then dedicate a book to someone who's a real person. I mean, what? It just gets more and more ridiculous. The idea that the Earl of Oxford wrote Shakespeare... The Earl of Oxford wrote poetry when he was a young man. Everybody wrote poetry when he was a young man. Remember the lover with a sonnet made to his mistress Eyebrow in The Seven Ages of Man? What happens to noblemen who have all got public duties to do is that they give it up when they come to a certain age. It's a typical vice of a young man, writing, working off his extra sexual energy in writing poetry. We can't be surprised if Oxford wrote poetry and then stopped. There's nothing unusual about that. In the case of Francis Mears, Palladius Tamia, he talks about the Earl of Oxford and about Shakespeare and about Francis Bacon, which seems to indicate that they're three separate people. Why try and conflate them? It may seem strange that Shakespeare's work is written by a man who didn't go to university, until you read the plays by the men who did go to the university, and then you realise that he isn't one of them. He writes in a completely different way, which is very close to the actual way people speak. You know, I love explaining to my sixth formers, because I do these big sixth form conferences in England, that actually iambic pentameter is like, first of all, the pentameter is like a heartbeat, systole, diastole. But the other thing is that when you talk to people, the way you talk is governed by the way you feel. It's governed by whether you're excited or anxious. It's governed by the length of your breath. It's governed by how deeply you inhaled. It's actually a dynamic of expressivity. We don't talk prose. We probably talk something more like iambic pentameter if we just listened. I mean, sometimes it's even more arcane. In England, people say, all right, then they pass you in the street. And you know what the answer is? All right. Because we do speak to each other in incantations. We do speak something more like poetry than prose, which is something the schoolmen writing plays did not understand. So they wrote plays in 14ers, and they wrote them in blank verse, they wrote them in all sorts of things. But they are hidebound, they are stilted and crippled. I think Shakespeare is as good as he is because he is a man of the people. That's not a problem for me. But then my Shakespeare's a little bit different. If you read the play of King John, that's one of the most subversive plays you could ever read in your life. It is a play that seeks to prove to you, as Shakespeare does elsewhere, not to prove so much as demonstrate that a man is more than a king, that a king is less than a man. It has to be done subtly, and it runs counter to some of the official versions of the histories and so on, because Shakespeare also invented the idea of England, you know, this precious jewel set in a silver sea. No. What happened to Scotland and Wales, you idiot? There's a good deal of strangeness going on. You will never find anybody write more movingly about what happens to soldiers than Shakespeare. You will never find anyone of his contemporaries writing about horses dying on the battlefield. Shakespeare is a man of the people, and in his dramaturgy there is always the offstage mob, which is the audience, the people, who are what reflects back all of that imaginative heat and light. And until you actually go to the Globe in London and realize that when Shakespeare's audience caught its breath, when they went, they made a wind. They actually altered the atmosphere in the room, that they were actors in the drama. Then you begin to understand why Shakespeare's different from everybody else. And he's obviously not a nobleman, and obviously not a schoolman, not a lawyer, not a politician. He's Shakespeare. End of story. He may turn out to have been 4 feet high and with bright ginger hair. I don't care. I mean, it's of no consequence. The plays are Shakespeare, and Shakespeare is the plays. And the Earl of Oxford is someone else, and Francis Bacon is someone else. And I don't care who they march past me. Whoever it is, for me, is Shakespeare. Or I can put it another way and say, it's Anne's husband.
That's all we have time for. What a great note to end on. I believe Dr. Greer will be signing books right down here. They're for sale in the lobby and right here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. You've been listening to radio.dominican.edu, Institute for Leadership Studies presentation of Jermaine Greer tonight, Monday the 30th of March, 2009. Stuart Horn signing off, thanking you for listening in, reminding you that Dr. Greer's lecture will be available for download right here on radio.dominican.edu within 24 hours. You can download it and enjoy it again and again. Thank you for being with us tonight. We'll send it back to the studio for more of the best of Indian Unsigned on radio.dominican.edu.